This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A conference on information technology and cybersecurity is being held at Western Michigan University today and tomorrow. Coming up, we'll talk with Alan Ray, a professor of business information systems in Western's Hayworth College of Business, about the challenges business face and how colleges and universities are working to address them. But first, the group Voters Not Politicians is nearing its goal of collecting enough signatures to put their proposal on the Michigan ballot in November of 2018. They want to change the way that boundaries are drawn for congressional and state legislative districts in the state. 316,000 signatures from registered voters in Michigan are needed to make the ballot. Bridge senior writer Ron French recently looked at how the group wants to end partisan gerrymandering, the experience in another state, and a possible legal battle ahead. Ron French, thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about what it is that Voters Not Politicians is trying to fix. What's the problem that they see? What do they want to do about it?
Sure. In Michigan and the majority of states, district boundaries are drawn every 10 years after the new census comes out to reapportion so that the populations are fairly equal. But Michigan, along with most states, those lines are drawn by some political group, either the legislature or the governor or a combination of the two. What happens is then the political party that is in power in that state, if one political party controls the legislature and the governorship, can tweak the lines to help their own party. There's nothing new about this. It's been happening for over 100 years. The difference, if anything, is that with computer power we have today, redrawing of lines can be a lot more effectively used to empower one party and disempower another. So that's the problem. Okay. And so what this group is trying to do is take the power away from politicians to draw those lines and give it to a group that is nonpartisan. And in their proposal, what they want to do is have a commission formed, an independent commission that would have four Democrats, four Republicans, and five people who are unaffiliated with either party. They would draw the lines, and to make sure that it is bipartisan, for those lines to go into effect, at least two members of that commission's Republican and Democrat and unaffiliated must vote yes. So it's not as if the Democrats and the unaffiliated can get together and say, let's screw the Republicans. This has to be bipartisan lines, the way that they're proposing.
So some other states have looked to change their process for drawing the lines for the state legislature and Congress, including California. You talked to some people out there. Explain how California does this.
Sure. California is a good example if Michigan voters want to know what could happen here. California is the closest template to what Michigan is proposing. In California, they also have a bipartisan commission made of Democrats, Republicans, and unaffiliated voters. And their commission has been in place for more than a decade, so it's long enough to see a track record to see what actually happens. So what has happened there? I was surprised by a couple of things. One, you do have more competitive races, which is the key, I think, for a group like Voters Not Politicians. They want politicians to have to talk to everyone and not just be able to count on their base of their own party to get them elected. So you have more close elections in California. When you look at in the most recent election in California for Congress, and you look and compare that to Michigan, the seven closest congressional races were all in California. And among races that were within 15 percentage points, so that, you know, that's not even that close to 15, but even going as far out as being a race that was 15 points separated or closer, 13 of those 15 are in California. So it does create closer races, which hopefully, I think this group would say, would mean that politicians are more responsive to voters. But the fear from Republicans here is that, oh, my God, they're going to take away our power and everything. In California, it really didn't change the makeup either of the legislature in California, the state legislature, or Congress. It made the races closer. Some incumbents lost when this first went into place, but the actual makeup did not alter that much. It did make things more competitive, though.
Well, but another way of looking at that is that California, to that point, Democrats were getting the majority of the votes statewide for Congress and their state assembly, and the Democrats had the majority of the seats. Whereas in Michigan, Democrats have been getting, the majority of the votes in some cases for, say, a state house statewide, but then the Republicans are in a pretty comfortable majority. I guess I'm just wondering if the Michigan situation isn't a little different going into this than what California was prior to their redistricting reform.
It might be. That's a good point, Gordon. I know that in 2016 in Michigan, in the state house, Democrats and Republicans both earned total about the same number of votes. It's very close. But Republicans won a clear majority of the seats. And so it seems like Democrats are being packed into certain districts. So it could be that if the race is more competitive and the lines were drawn, we could see a bit of a shift. I can tell you that the majority, all the opposition that I know of to this are among Republican leaders in the state.
And that point about packing voters into one district, that is part of the reason you get these very non-competitive races. It's actually for the party that's in the minority. They are winning their seats by large margins because, you're trying to put as many members of the other party as you can into the smallest number of districts. Isn't that the best way to describe it?
Very well put. You will have districts both at the state level and at the congressional level where one party's candidate will win by 40, 50, 60 points. You can make an argument if I'm in a congressional district that represents Detroit proper. Detroit's a very heavily Democratic city. It would be hard to draw a congressional line where that is going to be a very competitive race between Democrats and Republicans. And there are probably some examples of that on the Republican side also. But there is no reason to believe that there can't be more competitive districts than there are now.
So as we talk right now, does it appear that voters, not politicians, is going to be able to gather enough signatures to meet the state's requirement for getting a proposal on the ballot in 2018?
Almost without a doubt, they will. They already have over 250,000 signatures, and they need a little over 300,000. Even those who oppose this effort believe they will reach their mark easily. Even the opponents are quite impressed with how fast they've been able to gather signatures, which says a lot about the organization, and it says a lot about the appeal in the public for something that takes power away from politicians. We have this, and you see it at the national level too, Gordon, where this whole sort of drain the swamp attitude is out there. It's like that politicians aren't serving us. If we can put power more in the hands of people, things would be better. But anyway, so there is a general belief that yes, they will absolutely get enough signatures to get on the ballot if it survives some court challenges.
Now, we'll talk about the court challenges in a moment, but I want to go back here for just a moment to something that I find quite interesting about voters, not politicians. As far as we know, it doesn't appear they're paying anybody to gather petition signatures. And for a long time, I know people I've talked to in politics have said, conventional wisdom is you have to spend $1 million up front just to collect petition signatures. It appears that voters, not politicians, is defying that conventional wisdom right now.
Absolutely. The people I talk to say that if you want to run a fairly successful campaign, you got to assume you got to have at least $3 million. They are doing it with very small donations, and they're doing it with all volunteers. They have about 3,000 volunteers that have been around the state, and they're not just going to heavily Democratic areas. At the time that I spoke to leaders in that effort a few weeks ago, the highest percentage of voters that they had signed petitions was in Ottawa County on the west side of the state, which is a Republican area. There's some Democratic strongholds there.
One of the most conservative areas of the state, probably.
Sure, absolutely. And so you can see that this has cross-party appeal. But yes, what they've been able to do is they've used that grassroots effort as an advantage for them, because they can't, they at the moment at least, can avoid being labeled as being in the pocket of Republicans or Democrats or a certain organization that is pushing something, because this is really voter-driven. And from everything we understand, there's a lot of support for this both among Republicans and Democrats at the grassroots level.
So we've alluded to potential legal challenges. What could happen that even if voters, not politicians, was able to gather the signatures required, and they're from registered voters in Michigan and they meet all those legal requirements, what could happen that keeps that from getting on the ballot next year?
Many petition drives eventually end up in court, you know, challenging one thing or another. And it seems as if the Michigan Republican Party is gearing up to try to challenge this in court. The sense I get is the Republican leaders in the state feel court may be the best way to stop this, to be honest. They have legitimate reasons to believe this isn't good policy. But at the court level, it's not about whether it's a good policy or not. It's whether the petition is proper. And their argument in court, according to Bob Brandt, may be this, that the changes that this petition wants to make to the Constitution are too broad, that you can make through a voter petition small tweaks to the Constitution in very specific areas. But if it's broad and it changes a lot of the Constitution, it affects a lot of pieces of the Constitution, then it can only be changed through a constitutional convention. But other people say this is pretty narrow. So it will go to court. That will be one of the big arguments they make about it. We just don't know whether when it eventually gets to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, whether the justices will believe that.
And Bob LeBrant cites an earlier case as the example that he is hoping comes to fruition here. In the same case, it was it seems to me, reading your story, a much broader government reform, but it was thrown out by the court.
Absolutely. And this was in 2008. It was an effort called Reform Michigan Government Now. I'm sure some of you remember that. It was going to radically change the state. Everything from the number of Supreme Court justices to the number of people in the legislature. It included redistricting. And again, it was the sort of thing that probably had a lot of public support. In fact, one poll on it showed there was about 70% support for a ballot measure, which is crazy high. But it was thrown out in court because Bob LeBrant was able to argue that it changed too much of the Constitution for a specific voter effort like this, and it needed to go to a constitutional convention. But that was very broad. This deals specifically with redistricting. So I think it may be an uphill battle to make that argument in the Supreme Court on this particular effort.
What should we look for next, Ron?
I think next what you're going to see is they're going to announce probably in late fall, early December, whatever, that they've reached the number of petitions that they want to gather. They are trying to scrub those signatures before they turn them in. They're having an organization look at them and try to eliminate some of the ones that are duplicated before they turn them in. But there'll be some announcement. They will turn in, I wouldn't doubt they're turning in at least 400,000 signatures so they can lose some. And then there'll be a process where the state looks at those and declares whether they actually have enough to get on the ballot or not. After that is when you will probably see some court challenges filed.
Ron French is senior writer for Bridge. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Links to the stories on the Voters Not Politicians ballot campaign, California's reapportionment process, and the potential legal battles can be found at bridgemi.com and at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Information technology students and professionals will be at Western Michigan University, both today and tomorrow, for a conference called Exploring IT Innovation and Cybersecurity in the Digital Era. Among the presenters will be Alan Ray, professor of business information systems in Western's Haworth College of Business. He will be discussing information security education during one of the sessions tomorrow. Alan Ray, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, what sort of concern is there, for businesses, for universities, any institution, about security and keeping information safe?
Well, if you just even just watch the news every day, probably a week doesn't go by where you hear of some data breach or some loss of personal information. I mean, one of the largest ever, of course, happened most recently was Equifax, right? Losing all of this information that we all hold near and dear, we're told to protect, and yet that organization, you know, exposed it and your credit history and whatnot. So it's an ongoing battle. Whether it's just a small organization or a very large organization, there are information security threats hitting people at all times, even your own home systems, right? We're connected all the time now with our cable modems or our DSL modems. It's no longer people have dial-up. So you're always connected. So you're pretty much always out there on the internet.
And, you know, we're told all the time the things that we can do as consumers to try and protect our personal information.
Sure.
But in reality, in 2017, with all of the things which are done over the internet, is it realistic to say that you're not going to have somewhere in cyberspace personal information that a hacker could find valuable?
Yeah, I think that it's naive to think that your information is not out there in some form. I tend to be very careful with my information, protect it as much as possible, because I know what can be done. And when we still have instances where companies, whether they actually have your credit history like we've seen most recently and they lose it, or even just information aggregation, right? Small bits of information that you willingly give or you willingly put out there on social media, as we collect those bits and pieces, people get a better feeling of who you are and what you do and what you, you know, what you're interested in. So we do it for marketing purposes as well, too. So, yeah, your information is out there. How much of it depends. But I think, you know, everybody needs to take steps to protect as much as possible. But probably more importantly, monitor your own information out there to see if anything's being done with it.
Are certain types of businesses or institutions, I mean, we mentioned Equifax, but is that the sort of business which is going to be a richer target, I guess, for someone who is trying to mine this information?
Well, sure. We always talk about target-rich environments, right? One of the things is, you know, there does require effort to attack certain organizations. So we tend to hear more about the big ones, right, that have, you know, maybe large health organizations, or, you know, we've had Sony hacks or Yahoo's email or, you know, Verizon files. I mean, so we hear about those, but that doesn't mean other ones are not being attacked, because, to be honest, many of these tools that not the high level attackers use, but mid to low level attackers, are free and they're automated. So a lot of these attacks can occur even without the individual having the technical knowledge, maybe a minimal technology, but so they can do that. All these ransomware that we're seeing happening over and over again, where systems are locked up. There was a couple of organizations selling this service on the cloud. You didn't even have to have your own computers. They would sell you cloud time and launch an attack for you. And they would just take a cut of whatever you get. So, you know, it's become, in some aspects, a commodity that people are willing to pay for to attack other systems.
And has it become, in some ways, sort of an arms race where you've got one side which is trying to figure out new ways to get at this information, and the other side, presumably being businesses and other institutions that don't want it hacked, that they are trying to outwit each other? You've got one side trying to get the information, the other side trying to build new security systems to keep it secret.
It is an arms race. It is somewhat like cyber warfare, although it doesn't fit the classical definition of that. But one thing I always tell my students is, if you are in information security and you're trying to protect assets, you have to look for every possible attack vector, any way someone can attack you, and you have to try to account for that. An attacker only has to find one hole,
and your defenses. So in many ways, it's easier for attackers still these days because as a defender, you must account for every single way that someone can get into your system. And it's not always technology, social engineering, which basically plays on the humans aspect to trust or want to help one another, you know, also works against organization. So that's where we talk, making sure that we also have security education, training awareness, or SATA, we call it, in the field, so that users, you know not to click on that email attachment, even though they may still, right, and there's a piece of malware that, or an infected spreadsheet, you know, that does something. But so it is an arms battle. It is a race. It's one that, you know, we're constantly fighting in information security. So it's a growing field. Because there's more and more ways for attackers to get into information. And as, of course, we have more information that's electronic, right? Gone are the days of massive file cabinets full of paper everywhere. We're making everything electronic and everything accessible, which makes it easier for us, but also makes it somewhat easier for attackers.
Is this something that businesses are finding that they have to spend a lot of money on? Is it expensive if you truly want to keep this information secure?
I think businesses are spending money on it finally. For many years, they were not, and hoping for, and this is a generalization, but hoping for that security and obscurity, right? We're small enough, they're not going to find us, is what we call it, which is a bad technique. I think businesses are now becoming more formal how they go about it. They're starting to make sure that they have information security personnel on staff. They're starting to look at trying to make sure they have a director of security or information security or a chief information security officer. So they're starting to implement this because it's more than just the technology. And that's what we really stress, is that it's not, okay, we're going to buy X, Y, and Z piece of tech and we're good. It's more than the technology. It's also all the policies and procedures and how you deal with things and what your people are aware of. So it's a huge package to deal with, and businesses are struggling to make sure they cover all aspects. And that's why, you know, we're finding a lot of the stuff we're doing here at Western to try to help prepare professionals better to deal with this is quite useful.
And speaking of that, Western has launched an information security graduate certificate program. How does this work?
Well, what we've done is we need this well-rounded individual, right? It's not just somebody that can configure technology like a firewall or anti-malware. It's also somebody that can understand the processes and the policies that need to be in place. So the CIS program in the College of Business are working with the computer science program over in engineering. And so we've created this certificate that has students taking both technical and managerial classes. So that they have a better idea of what goes on what was traditionally, you know, two sides of the fence.
Is this something that grew out of, say, a demand in the business community of people saying, hey, we need people who are both technically savvy, but also have a little business experience and a little business knowledge so that they kind of see this as a holistic problem and not just simply if we come up with the best software, then
right,
we don't have to worry anymore.
Yeah, I believe so. The businesses are realizing that it's not an all or one. It's not all technical. It's not all just rules. And what was really interesting was a few years ago, extended university programs, which is another college at the university, approached us and said, hey, we're interested in pursuing something about InfoSec. And we said, okay, we'll put something together. And we did. And then they did market research. And I remember a couple years ago, they always have that initial meeting where they've done their market research and they tell you whether or not it's going to be a viable program. And we came into the meeting, and I had all kinds of stuff ready to argue, you know, why this would be a great program. They sat down and said, there's such a huge market demand that you don't need to justify anything. Let's just do it, right? So, because they'd done all this research. And I said, well, how often does that happen? And they're like, this is pretty much the first time. You know, so, I mean, there's really this huge demand out there. And the certificate started in the fall. So I just finished up one of the classes. It's completely online, so students do not have to even be in Kalamazoo, and we do have some that are not. Although our first offering here, we do have a lot of more local students and local folks who have decided to take it. But and it's also morphing into what will eventually, hopefully next year, be an MS, Master of Science in Information Security. Once again, all online offered, and you know, making sure that students have both technical and managerial training.
Why'd you decide to go all online?
Well, we found that it was, you know, there's a huge demand for it. There are not a great deal of graduate degrees or graduate certificates that are online. And probably another key component is most of our students are actually working professionals. So they already have an 8-to-5 or an 8-to-6 job. Many of them are already in information technology. Some have some security responsibilities. Some want to move into that area. And so it's not like they can come to campus a couple times a week and come to class. So we decided instead to do it online so that they take, you know, they work on the materials when they can. There are deadlines, you know, but it's up to them to, you know, meet those deadlines, and they do. These are professional students, professionals and taking classes. So it gives them more flexibility in many ways than they would if they had to come to campus. And we have a larger audience, really, because they don't have to be in Kalamazoo to take this degree.
Is security a growing field, a good field for someone to get into if they're a student and they think that they would like to go into something related to information technology? Would you recommend to them that they should take a good look at security for, you know, job prospects and those sort of things?
I would say so. And I do have some stats that I'll talk about when I present this. But from just last year alone up through July of this year, there were over 207,000 unique job postings for information security. And that was up 85% from just a couple of years ago. So 85% growth in that. And it's anticipated to grow another 20% and over the next 10 years. So it's just a huge field. Right now there's about, for every person, there's 2.5 to 3 jobs out there. So the ratio is you know, you have your choice, basically.
It's obviously not easy to know what's going to happen next. This is a changing dynamic sort
Correct.
Of thing. But as you sit here as someone who looks at this from an academic standpoint and trying to figure out where things are going, what else do you think colleges and universities need to be thinking about now when it comes to security and information technology?
Well, I think the key thing is just staying current. You know, although there are approaches that we've used for years in terms of how to assess situations, and they still work, we have more and more technologies coming in every day. I can remember just a few years ago when cloud computing was all the rage, and it was new. That information security people were having a tough time dealing with this because all of a sudden, the machines you usually protect in a couple of your data centers now could be anywhere, right, in the world. And so that took a while. And so now there are processes and procedures and techniques in place to handle cloud computing. And so now, and then we've had this wave that we're still struggling with Internet of Things, with devices going everywhere and recording and being attacked. You know, we've seen like the Mirai botnets and whatnot take over webcams and literally flood and take down sites with DDoS attacks. And, you know, and so now we have to deal with those. And who knows what will happen next as AI gets much more advanced and starts to do more. We'll hopefully be able to incorporate that some into our defense mechanisms. But you can be sure that attackers are going to incorporate that into their attack mechanisms. So it's always just staying abreast. And that's probably one of the toughest challenges, not only for academia to always stay right at the cutting edge of tech, but even just for business to stay up there, because it just becomes costly. But sometimes it's tough to, people get exhausted trying to stay up with that, but you have to, right? So there's always a constant need for more InfoSec people.
Alan Ray is professor of business information systems in Western Michigan University's Haworth College of Business. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Links with more information about the cybersecurity conference being held at Western today and tomorrow can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.